Welcome to Call Me on the Way Home, a podcast where we appreciate and grab a space of time that is separate from home and work, get into the minds of some of today's thought leaders. I think you're going to love this podcast today. It's on Danny Mock, a good friend of mine who is a financial advisor here in Los Angeles. It's the first podcast I've done that's in person. A quick summary of what you're going to hear about. It's going to be lessons Danny learned through high school, his college days, playing water polo, the coaching he did, and some of the Olympic development programs afterwards, why he got into financial advising, and learning to leave a legacy statement. I think you're really going to love this podcast, and I hope you look forward to it and enjoy it as much as I did recording it. Welcome, Danny Mock, number four, wealth advisor, F&B, wealth management. Where do you work? Where is home?
So home is the Conejo Valley.
Okay.
Which is Thousand Oaks, Westlake, Newberry Park, north of LA.
Okay.
Just inland from Malibu, below Santa Barbara.
I don't even know if I've heard that term. I think I've heard it one other time.
Valley.
Conejo Valley. It sounds fancy. It
means rabbits in Spanish. They're everywhere.
In town?
In town, yeah.
It's like a phenomenon. Like.
Yes. Yes, known for that. That's why they call it the Conejo Valley. But, home is Thousand Oaks. Office is in Westlake. Longest commute I've ever had is 7 minutes.
That's rough.
That's real rough.
In LA.
So I'm down to five now, and my wife's is six.
Okay.
So,
okay.
We've got it pretty comfortable.
That is nice. That is nice.
Yeah.
And this podcast is called Call Me on the Way Home. The principal idea of like who you talking with on the way home and what are you breaking down, because it's a safe space. Like,
yeah.
The idea is you're only going to call people you love and you want to talk, like you actually want to hear from, because it's not work stuff. It's not home stuff. It's just like, it's just something in the middle where you can learn from somebody.
Yeah.
And that's where I get real excited, is because I've got a Rolodex list of people I've known that are really interesting, that have taught me things, but I don't know how to share that with somebody, especially peers, right? Like people we know, they've done something.
Yeah.
But it's enough they ought to share it.
Yeah.
But they maybe don't know how.
Hmm.
And so like one of the questions I start with is, what have you learned you think you've mastered? You got a really good handle on. And I'll just lead out the gate with that one and let you take it.
Yeah. I think being aware of what you don't know, that's not what I was thinking about when you first kind of posed that question.
Mm-hmm.
But being okay with the idea that I'm not going to know everything,
mm-hmm.
I think is a very seldom recognized skill set.
Uh-huh.
People often probably want to, I wouldn't say I've mastered it, but it's one of the things I think that I would say I pride myself on a little bit, is being comfortable with asking for help. And not always, but that's a unique thing. I'm also really good at making Eggs Benedict. It's less interesting, but like it's relevant. Wait, for
what's Eggs Benedict? Egg Benedict?
Eggs Benedict.
Eggs Benedict.
Yeah.
Plural?
Okay. Part of it's plural. Yeah.
The first word's plural.
Yeah.
Okay. Southern people may not get that all the time. What is that again?
It's like an English muffin.
Okay.
With like, typically you use some kind of like ham, and then a poached egg, and then this hollandaise sauce, which is basically egg yolk and butter.
Okay.
And that's like my wife's favorite breakfast.
Got it.
I've gotten good at that.
Reps,
yeah.
Okay. Like, how many do you think you've made? How long have you been married?
2 years.
2 years?
Yes.
How many Eggs Benedict?
Probably less than you'd expect. Under 10, but I got really good really quick. So I would say that's my mastery.
Okay.
Actually, it's cooking for her, specifically.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I have really had a tough time with the cooking thing, because Chick-fil-A trained me for 6-7 years to throw everything away when you're done.
Mm.
And I really struggle with dishes and eating in.
Yeah.
Just, it was a habit.
Yeah.
Like you look at the quick service restaurant world.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's just tough.
Yeah, I really enjoy cooking, which is a great, it's a great thing to bring to a marriage.
it is.
She likes cleaning, incidentally.
Really?
And I loathe it. It's something I absolutely disdain. So it's actually a great trade-off.
Mm.
But so I'll make some stuff and I get to experiment, and she's like more than happy to try it as long as it's not spicy and doesn't have pepper.
Okay.
So we get to like try a bunch of different things, and like we're in that phase of life where it's like, all right, I'm home. Like, we're not running to the next thing usually, and so we get to kind of try some experiments and whatnot. And so COVID's been a unique opportunity to cook at home a lot.
Yeah. Do you think it turned up in COVID? Like numerical went up?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. In some respects. I think for the first probably 6 months, we felt like weird about not being at home, like probably like a lot of people. But so there was probably a period of post 6 months where life was just too crazy to eat at home too much. But yeah, I mean, I'd been cooking for years, probably since I was in like fourth, fifth grade. So I love it, and I always have. But then cooking for someone is always better than cooking for yourself. And so, like, being married is kind of ideal for that.
Yeah, it is.
Like, hey, we're going to try this type of steak tonight. I'm like, great, that sounds good.
Boom.
So.
And so I want to walk you chronologically through some things, because I've been listening to a bunch of different podcasts personally, and one spiritual, one's about high school, the other is about finances. But none of them really seem to draw it all together, except for the Joe Rogan Experience, which is on altitude most no one else is on.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a comparison.
It's the podcast.
Correct. Yeah. And it's almost like there's not something that blends them all. So I want to kind of compartmentalize and ask the same question, maybe with a timestamp around it. So what's a lesson? What do you think high school prepared you for? What lesson did you learn coming out of high school?
There's probably two things. The most important, I'll start with the least important. I found out that I really enjoy how things work. And I learned that in an economics class, and then I ended up going on to study that. And I had a great teacher who was super engaging, super smart, kind of went off script after we got through like the stuff we had to, and started teaching the things that were relevant in life. That was a very mechanical type of class that I remember sitting in and thinking like, all right, well, how does this, whatever it is, not a machine, but how does this, how does an economy work, right? Like, that was really interesting to me, and thinking about it as like a machine in itself, even though there's not pieces, like an actual, like, here's a gear and here's a whatever. Like, that was somewhat intuitive, but I think it has a lot of applications across many things beyond just like studying macroeconomics or whatever. Being able to think about like, okay, well, here's the input, whether I'm building something for work or I'm building something at home or process at home, that how we deal with our finances as a household. Totally new thing I learned as a married guy. That kind of logic was something I hadn't really thought through before. It was cool, but I think the more important thing was I think that's my sophomore year of high school is when I learned how to write well. And that's a skill that is really dwindling quickly in the Twitterverse, right? Like 144 characters or whatever it's at now, like, doesn't really or text messaging, like, doesn't warrant like well-written things. So it's noticeable when someone writes well, and I think I had a teacher in my sophomore year in particular, like, literally getting a 51% was a passing grade, and that's how hard she graded. And I probably got a 51, but I learned to write better than I had learned in any other writing class. I think that's probably something that shows up in a lot of different aspects, and it's noticeable when someone's not a great writer. I think that was probably the biggest thing I learned.
Do you judge them when they're not a good writer? I mean that in a silly way. What do you do? Like, as a good writer, and you see someone who's not, what do you say?
It definitely throws a hiccup into reading it. Like, if it's an email or something like that, it definitely like throws the rhythm off a little bit of understanding like what's happening with whatever they're sending me or whatever I'm reading. And I recently just started reading literature from like the 1920s, like a fiction novel, and it's like completely different style. And noticing the writing today versus that gives a different depth of the material. Like, Danae is reading a book that was written more recently, and just like the putting them next to each other, like, there's just a different wealth of like visuals that goes into that writing. And even if it's like a simple email, it kind of shows up. So sort of judgmental, probably shouldn't be, but A little bit, yeah.
One of the bosses I've had before was one of the editors at the UCLA newspaper. And he was able to craft professional emails with tone, with empathy, with emotion, because he would sound curious if something was off, and he'd sound firm when he knew he was right.
Yeah.
And most are incapable of those two emotions.
Yeah.
Period. And it came across in writing. And it was really fascinating to see, because he didn't speak like that.
Yeah.
But he wrote like that because he knew it was permanent.
Yeah. That's an interesting, yeah, because everything you write down will be there forever. There's no way to avoid that. Yeah, and it's and tone is something that usually gets lost in text,
Twitter.
Text, Twitter, email.
You didn't know that was a joke.
I did not know.
Like you just think, like you know, like
right. Yeah.
How do you?
And so being really clear with what you're writing is always really important because it's not just the words. Someone's going to read it different than you might intend it, and it can have a just like language, or like when you talk to like a kid or a dog, like you just change your tone and you might say the nicest thing and sound mean, and it totally comes off different. That sounds stupid analogy, but it's kind of true. Like that can happen in writing too. So being really intentional with the way you write, even simple emails or texts or something,
mm-hmm.
actually pretty powerful, I think.
Yeah. And you grabbed that in high school? Like, yeah. Or you at least got the beginning of it? Like
the beginning of it, yeah.
Implementing it? Like, did it show up somewhere?
I just remember like the first couple of papers I wrote in that class were just, I thought they were fine and they just were so subpar, it was embarrassing. And so it made me really think about the structure of how I'm writing and being more methodical. And I'm like a logic-oriented person. So like
one, what's the word you use?
Logic-oriented. So like
logic-oriented. Okay.
Yeah. So like structurally, like flow needs to be there, right? And so like if that doesn't come through really clearly in what you're presenting, like that's really not conducive to communicating something, right? Like so that plus how you structure sentences actually matters, and being not like overly formal, but balancing like, yeah, like the tone of like being human, but then also being somewhat formal, like a paper is going to be different than an email, is different than like a research article, whatever. So,
yeah.
And that was definitely like that sophomore year when I realized, wow, like you have to think before you write. I was the guy that would just like write a paper, not review it and submit it. And that kind of worked when it was every year before that functionally. And then that year on, actually that year, had to totally change that method of like submitting homework and papers. And then after that, it was normal. So I did well in those types of classes afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Which group did you run with in high school? Like was there a clique, or were you in one or not in one?
Which,
I don't even think I've ever asked you.
I don't think you have. I would say I was probably in like the catch-all where I played sports. Like, I was on the water polo team. We were good. Like, and like I could totally hang with those guys, but I would like sometimes be with them, and then there was like the other kind of classic cliques that were there, and I never really like, I was cool with them, didn't really hang out with them, but then it was just like we were like in the center of the quad, and you could tell exactly where everyone was, and like we just kind of like float between them, but mostly in this kind of like catch-all where it was like another buddy of mine who was like a phenomenal athlete but didn't like hang with the classic phenomenal athletes or whatever, and so we're just in this a little bit of like a couple like theater people, a couple of like athletes, just kind of random. Like, I never really thought of it though. Like, while I was there, like, should I be hanging out over there? I think it was probably because of my older sister though,
because
she was cool.
What was the impact? Did she say something, or she?
I just got to hang out with the, like, when I was a freshman, I got to hang out with the juniors if I wanted,
okay.
And like specifically, like, her teammates, like I would hang out with the girls' water polo team, the varsity team, when I was a freshman, and I had like, you know, obviously they were friends with the guys' team, so I got to know those guys a little bit, and like I didn't really hang out with them, but the girls, I would go to their games and like hang out with them, and
did that allow you to assimilate faster, like
definitely.
Kind of get over that freshman hump of
completely, yeah. So water polo is a unique entry point into high school, because most of the time, probably 80 to 90% of the times, the team has never played before, and you're coming into the summer, and there's like a couple guys who played before high school. It's kind of changing now, but most of them never did, and they're coming in like trunks, and that is a no-no in water polo. You can't wear trunks.
You don't wear jammers.
And you definitely don't wear jammers. jammers are the shorts, but they're like tight. I was the only guy at that point that had like a Speedo, and so I stuck out like a sore thumb, but in the right way.
You got it. Because you'd played before?
No, because she had been playing.
She knew. You've seen it.
All of a sudden, yeah. And at the time, she was dating a guy who was on the team who was a senior when I was a freshman. And so I like had a little bit of the in, like I knew these guys, whatever, and like not really, but roundabout way to like knowing them. So that was like the advantage I had getting into the pool first, was I was the only guy on the freshman squad with like a Speedo. And like by the end of the week, everyone did. But
gotcha.
It's like one of those little things that's totally irrelevant in the grand scheme, but it was like, yeah, it made it a little easier.
I got this. I can do this.
Yeah. Terribly uncomfortable because I was pasty white.
Sure.
I wasn't fit.
Still, I was about to say still are, but you look like you've gotten in shape, so I'm going to...
Thank you. Still pasty white. Not in that type of shape. Like, I'm better shape than pre-water polo, worse shape than water polo.
Okay.
So,
okay.
But, the perception, you know, how you look is half the battle entering high school.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're wearing a Speedo, you feel uncomfortable, but in the right context.
If you'd be yoked or jacked while wearing it, it takes an edge off.
Probably would have been on varsity and having never played, right? Like, yeah, no, I remember that. And then the funny part was I played volleyball too, which was the off season. Completely didn't do swim, completely transitioned out of aquatics and Speedos for like 6 months. And then going back into it was a total nightmare. Like, again, pasty white. Like, I looked like a freshman, but I wasn't. Like, I mean, it was, you know, whatever. And so, yeah, that second summer starting was, like, kind of funny, too. But then ended up just playing water polo. That was it after that. So,
gotcha.
I would say that was, like, a hurdle that was, or helped kind of, like, jump that first hurdle of getting in. It was, like, comfortable, like, totally uncomfortable with the situation, but, like, went with it and, like, I was the first one to do it, and everyone by the end of the week was, but...
Yeah, yeah. It at least says to the crowd, hey, look, this is maybe not my first time. I at least know what to wear.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you can't show up to a mosh pit in the wrong outfit, or, you know, I think about, you know, various uniforms. I mean, military uniforms or police uniforms, like what you says. Dave Chappelle, one of his recent... three specials he released, he's got a bit about police officers in their uniform and girls who are dressed as ladies of the night in their uniform, and they've got, you know, what you says actually says something.
Totally.
You know, it does say something. Yeah. The other part is, like, I was wanting to transition, I don't know how to, so I'm just going to jump to college, because you played water polo and then you went to school for water polo.
Yeah, so in high school, we were like a pretty legit team, and water polo kind of ends after college, and honestly, I didn't think I was going to be good enough to play at all in college, and we were actually playing in Thousand Oaks, at Thousand Oaks High School, my senior season, and the local university, Cal Lutheran here, where I went to school, their coaches were recruiting or whatever, it was Division III, so... they reached out to my coach and said they'd like to chat with me and were interested in maybe me coming to play. And I was like, wow, it's the first time I ever thought about playing after high school. Like, cool. So that was like, I grew up in Glendale, so I'm, you know, about an hour's drive, 45-minute drive out to CLU. So made a trip out and was like, wow, this might be an opportunity to actually play, keep playing, because I thought I was basically done. It was just going to be like rec league kind of stuff. And I ended up coming and playing in college here. Played 4 years. Learned a ton, figured out that I wasn't as cool as I thought I was, wasn't as good as I thought I was, and played 4 years, and then ended up coaching for a while too.
Okay. How long did you coach for?
Better part of 6 years, something like that.
Oh wow.
Like,
okay.
A bunch of different levels. So like,
okay.
My first entry was just kind of club. One of the coaches runs a club locally here, and so I coached that kind of just off-season stuff and like picking up little hours here, and always thought it would be really fun to coach. Ended up coaching at a local high school for a little while, and then when I was finishing up my playing career, I had the opportunity to get my master's and then also coach, and they, as a grad assistant, they kind of paid for some of the degree and whatnot, so I got to kind of coach a bunch of different levels and coach the Olympic development program and with some of the best coaches around, which was really super cool. Learning from them, and yeah, it was awesome.
Wow, that's neat. Yeah. I don't know if I've asked you the specifics. I mean, because we've hung out before, yeah. But I don't know if I knew it was like that ODP. Because
yeah,
ODP, in the South, ODP was just soccer.
Yeah.
Like, ODP was real big in soccer because there wasn't really another youth sport integration.
Right.
And, like, I'm pretty sure they found Kelly O'Hara that way. Mm-hmm. So, my high school, there's a World Cup winner and gold medalist.
Yep.
And she came from that world. You know, south side of Atlanta, soccer, boys and girls, is reputable in the country. Like, I mean, it's just...
Yeah.
Granted, when you got one human like that,
yeah,
it also helps.
Sure.
Our girls won state our senior year, and our boys lost state in the last 30 seconds of senior year. 1-0 to the team. The football team lost to in the third round of the playoffs. So, like, high performing, above average high school performance, and it wasn't just one school. It was all the soccer in the whole county.
Yeah.
Which counties are a little different, but you know, your region.
That's super cool.
It's just really different.
Yeah.
Anyways, I was thinking you mentioned 2 degrees and lots of coaching, lots of water polo.
Yeah.
I guess the best question I can come up with is the water polo lessons.
Uh huh.
As a player and then as a coach.
Yeah.
And then we'll ask something else.
Yeah.
What did you learn as a player? Because, like, the high school version of Danny said, you don't know what you don't know, right? Like,
yeah,
that teacher beat it out of you.
Yeah.
You know, but I think you probably had a similar experience to me going into football.
Yeah.
I was decent in high school. I'm the worst in college.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I got a different level to play up to.
Yeah.
What lesson do you think you learned as a player?
Yeah, that talent will get you only so far, and you know, being 6'2" is not a talent, and being like mildly athletic because of your parents is not a talent. It's just like it is how it is. But there's like talent, there's athleticism, and there's kind of these natural features that show up, and they only get you so far. And I was very much confronted with how far they got me. And super humbled after that. And that's when I learned how to work hard. Like, legitimately. Got really close to quitting. Because I thought I was all good, this and that. And did not start on the team. And thought it was not my fault. And then I realized, totally is my fault. And so I kind of got a little frustrated. And I was like, I can either quit or I can kind of like grow up and just do it. Just figure it out and give it like the hardest effort I've ever given anything to that point. And I did that, and I was like, wow, like hard work pays off a little bit. And so it ended up being awesome, and it was brutal. I hated every minute of it, like as far as like being benched. And then the training to like put in the hard work to win that starting spot was rough, and there was no help from anyone. Not that people were in my way or preventing me, just you just can't, like in Division III, you just literally are not allowed to train with a team. So I was living in Glendale at the time, or La Cunada, and I was forced to train on my own. And it was literally like, all right, if you don't do it, like no one's gonna do it for you, and no one's gonna encourage you, like you just gotta go do it. So that was the summer before my junior season, when I was like, all right, I'm like actually gonna try and make this thing, like see how far I can go and like really work hard. And that was the time when I realized it's probably the thing that was most beneficial in all aspects of my life, was like actually being told like you're not as good as you think you are, and then being forced into the position like, if you don't like that, you can either do something about it with you, which is A, quit, or B, freaking work hard. And so I was like, I'll try working hard for once. Like, not that I slacked, but I kind of got through things pretty simply without like really grinding. And that was kind of true of high school water polo and academics, and like it worked all right. Things were kind of cruising, but I think that was the moment when I wasn't as cool as I wasn't as cool as I thought I was. I wasn't as good as I thought I was, but I also had the ability to do all those things that I wanted to do.
Mm.
And I kind of pushed it to the limit, and I still wasn't as good as I thought I was, but I at least had perspective that I kind of knew where I fell, and water polo is not a big sport. I kind of knew where I fell, but it was higher than I had been, lower than I thought I could go. Humbling. in a good way.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
You mean you think you had a chance to go further? Or do you mean, like, you knew at the level, like, the time, energy, and effort, you're like, I'm all right with where this ended?
I think I actually probably got to my athletic maximum.
Okay.
I don't think I could have been much better than I was. And it was, I probably before that thought I was better than that. But then when I pushed as hard as I did and kind of got to that peak, I realized how much further there is, even just in college. Like, there's a lot of dudes way better than me. But I was, so I thought I was, like, better than I actually became, realized that I couldn't get much better than that, and I was actually pretty pleased with the result. Like, not disappointed that I wasn't, gotcha, like, a Division I All-American or something. Like, that I put up a, you know, a great couple of seasons in Division III. Like, thought it was pretty good effort. I was pretty pleased with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned 2 degrees. What was the undergrad degree in?
So I was a double major in economics and political science.
Oh, okay.
Most people think that sounds ridiculous, because it kind of is, honestly. Economics is boring to most, and political science is, I wouldn't call it science, but so I did that, and then I got my master's in quantitative economics.
Say that for the slow people who listen to this in the boondocks.
So, master's of science in quantitative economics. So,
okay. What's quantitative?
So, quantitative, so kind of a summary. Economics, you can kind of be theory-based or more mathematically-based or practically-based. Theory is kind of like, we believe this happens, you know, plug and chug. Like, if this happens, X happens, Y will happen as a result, or you input this, you output this. The quantitative part is basically putting mathematical formulas to it and getting a little more, I won't say technical, but economics is, there's a really wide range of things you can go. You can go from, like, explaining what's been happening or what has historically happened to things like forecasting, and those are really different. And then the way you go about them is really different. This was more on the side of, like, math heavy, thinking about, like, kind of like the term now is, like, big data. Like, you take a lot of data and you forecast what you think will happen with whatever, right? Great example is, like, say a business needs to produce something, right? Like a manufacturer, right? We know our clients or our customers, you know, they buy this much in the summer and this much in the fall, and you can kind of start to predict things. And, hey, these types of trends are showing up where we want, like, I don't know, green shirts instead of blue, right? You can kind of forecast what, you know, consumer demand will be, and you can kind of build your business around what you expect it to be. And so you make a more efficient business, and you can do this with any number of things. Forecasting is basically taking, like, a whole mess of data, figuring out building a math equation to explain it, and then whatever the math tells you, like, that's the course we're going to go, or that's what we think will happen.
Okay. So you rely more on the data than the theory in quantitative.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So qualitative is going to be, like, theory-based, talking about big picture, like what drives the economy? Well, we think it's, like, consumer spending and business investment and government spending and all these, and net exports, right? Like, how much you send out versus how much you bring in as an economy. And, like, that's a big picture macro. And that's kind of not just qualitative, but quantitative takes that and says, okay, if we think that, let's see what the data says about it. And then if we see what the data says and it confirms that, can we project, you know, what do we think is going to happen next if oil demand spikes or supply shrinks like it did, you know, last year or whatever. So taking the data that you're seeing and then trying to make some informed decision about or some informed estimation of the future. And so the quantitative part was understanding all the math that goes into it. And you rely heavily on computers to do the calculations, but
sure,
having to learn about what the computer's actually doing and developing like a framework for that. I couldn't do it now, frankly, because it's really, really involved. But the logic makes a lot of sense. So a great example would be, like, you could look at all of history and say, this is what the economy did based on, you know, all these different input factors, whatever it is. And then what do we think is going to happen next quarter? And that's basically what economists do.
Okay.
So that's the quantitative side of it.
Okay.
So super uninteresting, I'm sure,
for most people. For most people, it might be. For Austin, who's sitting here with you, like, it's kind of, that is not something I've ever learned about. And so I get really curious about, like, that nuanced, okay, who's the import? Is that a red party or is that a blue party input?
Right.
You know, because I know from my economist professor, he said, I don't work for the red party or the blue party. I work for the green party.
That's right.
And he rubs his fingers and thumb together in the money sign going, I'm going to make this sound good for whoever's paying me to write this article.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I realized you can sway people with research.
Totally.
Like as an uneducated kid in college going, well, econ, supply and demand.
Yeah.
And like, that's about all I knew.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he laid it out to what that would look like.
Yeah.
And how he can make that work for both parties.
Yeah. And the amazing thing is that economics, like, it's a lot of times put in this box of like, it has to do with business or, you know, an economy only. But this was what was interesting about high school was like that logic process of like what goes in and then what comes out later can be applied a lot across a lot of different things. It's more a study of behavior than it is about like, oh yeah, like money supply and businesses. It's like, it actually has very little to do with that. It actually has much more to do with behavior.
Yeah.
And that can be applied in micro terms, like a single person or a single set of people, or macro terms of like many people and many governments. And but that logic is coherent across both of them. It scales from one person to the entire globe, generally speaking. So that's what I always found interesting was like how much like it's like incentive based, right? Like understanding what makes people decide certain things is at the end of the day economics.
Yeah. Like we just read and then we sold it because we're doing the eBay flipping thing.
Yeah.
The Undoing Project, which is a story of Daniel Kahneman and his counterpart that both won the Nobel Prize in Econ. Who was Kahneman's? They were the first people to father behavioral economics.
Yeah.
And the story is their narrative.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because they were two different people, two different skill sets. One passed away early. The other got the call for the Nobel Peace Prize for economics. And it was just fascinating because they talked about incentive behavior.
Yeah.
You would love the book. Like, I've been recommended Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, or Think Fast, Think Slow.
Yeah.
I can't remember which. It's in my Amazon wish cart of just how to think about making purchase decisions. Because right now, it affects an individual I know who I go to church with, who is in Section 8 government housing, who was paying $53 a month for rent. Now he has a job. He's off unemployment. And rent 10x'd.
Yeah.
Now it's 550 something.
Yeah.
Where's the incentive for him to continue to work?
Yeah, exactly.
I have no idea. Because he comes from a very challenged background.
Yeah.
With not a ton of support. And how do you get somebody out of that?
Yeah.
And I'm watching him struggle and decide. And literally, he's faced with a choice. Mm-hmm. Choose to or choose not to.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting how he decides, right?
Completely. That's like a perfect example of like microeconomic theory about like how much better is solution A versus B on a marginal meaning, like the next step kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, if he's making, you know, $200 a month in unemployment, he's got to, like you said, rent 10x's. He's got to 10x his income or something maybe to like, or actually probably 11x in order to make it valuable enough to switch, right? To go back to work or something like that, right? Like it's a...
Correct.
I don't know if that's the exact math, but that logic of like decision-making is fundamentally what economics is about. Whether, again, any size entity or any type entity and any quantity of them. Like mm-hmm. the logic is still mm-hmm. there. It's like...
Still the same.
The least popular thing to say is it's like people make self-interested decisions on a daily basis, and it's not popular because self-interest is... It's a negative connotation a lot of times, but truly, it really is like people are going to make those decisions. And I mean, there's a whole mess of like, okay, well, what about this and that? And at the end of the day, though, it's like charity, for example, like well, they're doing that and they don't get any benefit from that. Well, they get some social benefit and some personal benefit, maybe not financial, but that's a net better for them. That's why they decide to do it, right? And so it's kind of reductive thinking, but at its core, like, that's what economics is. Like, everyone's making a self-interested decision. It might on its face look really greedy or really selfless, but at the same time, it's fundamentally what it is.
It is, and you can see it apply to other things once you understand the basics.
Yeah.
The problem is, I think for your general public, they don't want to read a book on econ.
Right.
Like, the only reason The Undoing Project's popular is its narrative. Like, it's exactly. A novel. Like, it's a good story of two dudes who are totally different, who come from, one from the Middle East, other from America, I think. Don't quote me on that one. Like, paired together to make some of the best behavioral economics theory in the world.
Yeah.
That everything we do at this point, they started in the 70s.
Yeah.
Like, that's not fun reading for your average listener.
Correct.
Like, it's tough. Like, hard people go for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's why they make the reading of about the story a little bit simpler.
Yeah.
And it's your job to kind of dive further if you want more.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know? And so I think
wrote that down.
Yeah, I think that's why books, like, reference so many. I was just reading a book about that today. Like, it's an old book. It's a church thing. Man in the Mirror. It's from 86, and it sounds like it's from 1986.
Yeah.
And it's talking about, like, I can only get you so far. Man, I'm trying to think who said this. No, it wasn't Man in the Mirror. It was Radical Personal Finance, Joshua Sheets, who's right now, I think, somewhere in Mexico, he sold everything. Him and his family are traveling. There's no end date. They bought one-way tickets.
Mm.
And he's looking for business opportunity outside of America. Granted, he's radical. It's very different. But he's trying to figure out how to pay less taxes, earn more money in really general senses, and traveling to do it with his family.
Mm.
And he's taught all his kids Spanish.
Wow.
With books at the house through homeschooling. You know, and I've seen an Instagram picture of 20 Spanish books for children, like a series, you know? And like, oh, okay, that's how you do that. You read to them lots and lots and lots of reading. And so it's just interesting kind of... What I'm doing now is I'm trying to distill all these things into something usable for someone else.
Because
they're probably not going to go read it.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make it simple so they understand what that's about. So maybe we can benefit from it.
Thank you for listening to Call Me on the Way Home. Please make sure you are subscribed to the podcast and make sure to share what you learned from this episode with at least one friend. Now, back to Austin's interview with Danny.
So economics is just a bunch of self-interested people making self-interested decisions. That's it. That's literally it. And why they do it, right? Like, that's...
You're onto a bit that, if you massaged it, could hit home run. I like that. You're onto something right there.
And it's totally not a thing for people. Like, people hate that logic of that. A lot of times it gets called greed. And famous economist Milton Friedman said greed is, like, it has a negative connotation, but it's not a bad thing. Like, you can replace it with nicer words, but functionally it's just that, you know, people make decisions for their best interest. And when it collides with, like, at the end of the day, maybe it never collides with someone else's best interest, or their self-interest, I should say. But when it does, most of the time, like, people make that, again, there might be social benefit to, like, laying themselves down for it, whatever, right? And actually them taking the hit, like, someone else. But anyways.
No, you're good, man. We're just working through it. There is a story inside of you that I loved when I heard it about your current role and why you do it and what you do it for. So can you tell me how you went from Masters of Science in Quantitative Economics?
Yeah.
Got it. And moved into what you're doing now?
Yeah. So it goes back to two different points in my life. The first was, I'll start with the second one. A buddy in high school whose dad worked in finance, personal wealth management stuff. And I always thought it was really amazing that he could always be at his son's water polo games. Amazing family. But he was always there for it. I knew he, like, worked hard, and I think he did really well, and, like, it was just really cool to see him a huge component of our team. Like, he was part of the team. He was kind of legendary. Like, if he wasn't there, a game kind of wasn't happening. And so, and I remember thinking how cool that was. And granted, my family made it to a lot of games, even especially when we were in college and we were all over the country and this and that. But there was something about him being at, I think, every single game we had, even like the little scrimmages and this and that, and super involved. That was interesting to me from that perspective, because I never had the idea that I would be working like completely rigid life of like, you have to be completely locked up or whatever for every, you know,
banking hours.
This idea of like, Jeff Bezos doesn't call it work-life balance, he calls it work-life harmony, and that was a term I just learned probably a year ago. And but that logic there is really different. And but the one that really started it all off and kind of like really put the fine point on it was when I was 13, my mom passed unexpectedly. And our parents had separated when we were younger, and both had remarried, and she was running a business, and we were living with her primarily, and then she passed unexpectedly. And I remember we had a family friend, still talk with this amazing guy, played water polo, does what I do, and probably the thing that really really like solidified this as probably the thing I want to do for my career is the fact that with all of that crap going on of her passing and then shifting from living with her to living with my dad and my stepmom and my little sister who was not yet born, in a different town, like an hour away, but still going to our same school, was the fact that we never had to stress about the finances. And it was like, and it that sounds like a little bit like what a financial advisor might say, but like knowing that she had thought about all those things that could go wrong and planning around it, to know, because the person who passes doesn't get any benefit from that planning, frankly. Like, there's no net benefit to them at the end of the day because they passed, right? But why she did it was specifically for my sister and I. Made sure that we would be okay should something like that happen, and we were. She provided enough for us to get through school and have a little bit extra, but not enough to do nothing. And that was a term I heard, was enough to do anything, not enough to do nothing. And it wasn't like she left us this big pile of money, but she got us through school. And I don't know how school would have been if, you know, like, she would probably would have figured out how to get us through school and this and that, and our dad obviously too. And but it was something that we didn't have to think twice about. Like, we were able to do, like, go to the university of our choice and get that like education we wanted, and it was like, it was provided for. And that was very early on, that I had no idea like what the industry actually was like. And it was just unique to have someone who had thought about that with her along the way and put us in a position where we weren't, because you hear sometimes about like families who don't make it out of a situation like that well. Or who don't have the right infrastructure, even if all like the math and all the planning has been done right, like the infrastructure of like family has not been thought about, and like who's gonna do this and that in the middle of all the turmoil. And so those two events of like seeing my buddy's dad doing it in high school and like the harmony he had in his life with his kids and with his wife and like his business and all these things, and then also going through an experience where it was like it was handled well personally, made it natural to want to do that. And then specifically, what I love talking about is how people make a difference, like with their life and what they built. And that was something my mom was really passionate about. It was like she worked with, she was a therapist, and she worked with like orphans and like children that had been neglected, and like just loved on those kids, like just took care of them. And it was just like so sweet. And it was, her life really emulated like giving to other people, and it was just something incredible. And so, you can express that in a billion different ways, but there was just something really unique about that. Yeah.
One of the, that's where our friendship started. Mm-hmm. You said, I know what it's like to lose a parent and for this to go well. Yeah. I've seen what it's like if it's not planned for and it goes poorly. Yeah. because it rips families further apart.
Completely.
Through a devastating loss of a parent or a patriarch or a matriarch or somebody significant in that family. And, you know, I knew then you were just a little bit different of a financial advisor. And, you know, like, I just lump all of you together.
Easy to do. Like, you understand it. I get it.
Like as insurance agents, we kind of get a pinch above car salesmen, used car salesmen. And so, you like, it's rare to find a special one that does have other people's interest at heart, because that's where it came from. Yep. You know, that's where it comes from, because you've seen somebody write a check to put a family back in business.
Yeah.
Whether that's their literal business, or that is their mortgage,
yeah,
or that is the house, or the kids' financial,
yeah,
you know, their college or whatever. It's just really powerful to see that. And it is, it's rare when it's done really, really well.
Yeah.
And I remember coming here to FNB and going, there's something different going on here. And like, I've told you this before,
yeah,
you know, offline, like, it seems like it'd be great if you made a ton of money, but it'd be better if you made a lasting impact.
Yeah.
At least that's what I feel. Like, it's not, you don't have that written on the door. That's the other part. It's like, there's no slogans in this office.
Right.
Like, it's who you guys are.
Yeah.
That has drawn.
That's awesome that you.
Me to you. Yeah. You know? And like, seeing the move you made with your client service rep.
Yeah.
And just a little different things, you know, and
yeah,
you're like, okay, this is a little different. Now, I do have a couple of questions that I'm going to ask you about wealth and money.
Yeah.
And you have a disclaimer for the lawyers.
That's right. Yeah. So obviously, like, it's like a personal conversation too. But like, obviously it comes up, like, what I do for work, but, obviously anyone listening should understand, like, this is not going to be financial advice specific to anyone, right? Like, I'm not going to give advice. Like, if there's something that pings someone, they should definitely talk with an expert that knows them, knows their situation, is an expert in their field, whatever, tax or legal stuff. They need to speak with someone that knows their specific situation, the applicable laws, rules, and all that stuff.
Okay. No problem. All right. We're done with that. So one of the first questions I had about some of the finance stuff is, how do wealthy people become wealthy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's probably a couple avenues. The one that we tend to see, two avenues are typically kind of push one to the side, is they might inherit the wealth. That's not a big number of people. I would say that you would call wealthy, like, they're not, it doesn't happen a lot. The people that you're probably talking about is how do they build their wealth? It's making a lot of really good quality decisions, not because every decision is going to go right, but enough good decisions start to add up over time. And you can't control everything, but, you know, it's kind of like the economics thing, like, little tiny decisions about, do I get store brand or name brand, you know, like, those tiny things are probably decent indicators of if that person is thinking bigger picture. I think a lot of times that behavior actually shows up throughout a number of different aspects of their life. I think it's discipline. I think it's, like I said, small decisions are indicators of probably how they'll make bigger decisions, and it's just making good ones along the way. There's no recipe beyond that of, like, you invest in this and you get this out. Like, you do the best you can. It's really a behavior thing.
Yeah, I like that answer, but I kind of don't like that answer.
I know.
You know, because, like, I wish there was more to it than discipline. And excellent small choices played out over a long period. I wish there was a faster light switch.
There might be.
But
I could tease it out a little. Like, I would say, willing to forego the now for the later.
Yeah. That's huge.
Yeah. There's a whole economic theory, in fact, about it, and I can't remember what it's called.
Delayed gratification?
Yeah.
Something along that?
Something, that's exactly what it is. But
is there a more specific term?
There's a more specific term, but you can see it in economic studies, actually behavioral studies. I wouldn't call them economic, but the economists snag it for their purposes. But you ask a kid, like, do you want this now or this much more later, right?
The marshmallow experiment.
Yeah, exactly. And it shows up in a bunch of different ways. And that's the funny anecdote that you hear now is like, oh, the millennials and their avocado toast. Like they'll never have a house because they're buying avocado toast. And like, of course, it's not like one avocado toast that's making them forego their.
That's a bit much,
right? You know, but the idea that instead of doing that, I'm gonna have like peanut butter toast. Incidentally, I had that for breakfast with a banana, and I haven't had that in like probably 2 years.
Humble brag. Go ahead.
But I did have avocados over the weekend, so. Somewhere in the middle, but it's delaying the gratification, knowing that, and this is applicable at a lot, like in faith, in business, in personal life decisions, like that shows up again. Like it's kind of it's not one specific thing. It's kind of that being able to delay that gratification, knowing that enough of it. Again, the small decisions will pay off over time, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, and kind of the idea of compounding, right? Like, forget the investment component of it. Just, like, compounding good decisions. Compounding, foregoing things that you don't need, or, you know, call them luxuries, even if they're not that luxurious. Like, do I really need that? Mm-hmm. Do I really need store brand when it's, like, 1% better but 50% more expensive? Like, is it really worth it? You know? Like, so I think that, yeah, that delayed gratification is a really big deal. And I think it also just shows up in how they deal with literally everything. Through all stages of their life, like, yeah, whether they're 25, 75, 105, or, you know, what, any decision, really.
Have you seen anybody who wasn't doing it right and decided to change and actually make the change, and it worked well?
Yes. Yeah, you can't replace time lost, but if you never change course, it'll never get better. And that's like a really broad statement to like cover the bases of like, of course that's a truth, right? But no, I've known people that have taken a while to come around to making really quality decisions, and then it takes a bigger sacrifice. Like just thinking in the world of, you know, what I do for work, like it takes a lot more sacrifice probably to catch up.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can for sure right the ship. Under most circumstances, it's rare that, you know, I just think that behavior of being able to, the discipline enough to change course is probably also, it might be a good indicator. Or will they stay on that changed course? Right. It's easy to revert back sometimes, but the further you get down that good decision making path on, again, whatever it is, forget wealth for any perspective for a moment, but. Kind of just changing course and sticking with it just gets easier and easier and easier, probably.
I think what you're saying is some sort of inherent groove. Like once you get on a groove, make it hard to get out of that groove if it's the healthy choice. Or if it's the unhealthy choice and you like it and it feels good, you know, like I guess you put up barriers to stay in the bad choice lane.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. Like you don't pick up that call from somebody who needs to tell you stop doing that,
right
or you withdraw from people who would give you wisdom or knowledge or some version of correction. That guy I referenced earlier, the church guy, that's kind of crazy, he blocked me on my cell phone and I have his house keys. Like we're close, very close, but he was even pushing me away because I was trying to help him make better decisions. Yep. And it's more comfortable for him to make the bad decisions.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's been a real test of human psychology.
Mm, yeah.
And I think, I remember I met some Northwestern Mutual guys back in Atlanta, Athens.
Yeah.
And one thing that they said that really surprised me is we're now not so much interested in finance per se, but more human behavior.
Totally. Totally true.
Like, they had mastered, I mean, decade plus into their field. And so they can say that. Yeah. 15 years, 20 years into it. And their whys were extremely powerful for them.
Mm.
Because they wanted to understand how people ticked.
Yeah.
And how to find the people who are ticking well. Right? Because they probably have more assets that they can manage.
Yeah.
Which is a healthy end for them.
Sure.
Which is fine. But, it goes back to Milton Friedman's greed.
Yeah,
to some degree, but it's not negative greed. It's healthy for both the person with the assets that does not know the next level.
Yeah,
and it's also helpful for the guy who's managing the money.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a kind of a, you hear Dave Ramsey talk about this too. It's like a lot of times we're trying to tackle an emotional problem with a math solution. And I think that the behavior is a lot more powerful than the math usually. Now, the math is important, but of whatever it is, right? Like the economics of making wealth planning decisions, or the economics of, call it your grocery shopping, or nutrition. Like, how do you, like, that's another great example of delayed gratification, right? Like, am I going to eat my vegetables first? Like, that's lame. But maybe you need to do that in order to, like, then not, like, you know, like, it's easier to start with dessert, but, like, is that the right thing to do? And so, like, we know the math, right? Like, we know that to some degree. It's that human side that's really hard, and that's something that I think is pretty powerful. You start to get to, the like you said, the why of why people do whatever they do, whether it's what they do for work, why they make certain decisions. Like, that's going to be more powerful than, like, here's the math. Like, yeah, everyone gets the math. Like, you can really stand on a lot of, you know, the shoulders of a lot of giants with the stuff that exists out there of knowledge, but there's something human about, like, that is irrelevant to that. And yeah. It's pretty powerful.
One of the other questions I was going to ask about your clients is, do you see trends or do you see themes with their behaviors or their investment choices? Because most of the millionaires I've heard about, the really wealthy, take the 9 richest people in the world,
yep.
The billionaires, you know, the 100 billion plus firms, they all own a large portion of stock in a publicly traded firm that they themselves started.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. I don't think if we do the math from the previous 50 to 70 years, because Warren Buffett's on the list, all of us are going to start that publicly traded firm.
Right.
How do I go from here to there? Like, what? Is there some trend? Is there some predictable... Make it easy for me. You know, I'm Austin. I got concussions. I played football. I don't know it all. Like, you know, like, is there a trend that some of your wealthy clients do that maybe your less wealthy clients don't do?
You know, there are some cases where it is that, like, outlier kind of effect where, I mean, look at how many. So let's just take all the public businesses in the U.S. I think there's 3,500. Let's just say that the founder still owned, like, what Jeff Bezos did. Somewhere like 15% ballpark, somewhere around there. I mean, there's 3,500 people that you would put into that category of, like, they made it and they held on to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you look at the ones that are worth as much as Amazon, $2 trillion, something like that, and there's, like, 4. So, you know, that's a super micro subset of people. There's probably 1,000x of those people who were on that same, like, a business that may be able to expand to publicly traded and massive and this and that, and, like, under the right circumstances would be the people you know the names of, right? I would say that that's not to discourage people from doing that, because you can build wealth in non-public businesses for sure, and you don't even have to be as successful as, you know, a $1 billion enterprise to be really well off. It's an outlier effect, but I think, you know, there's probably more wealthy people who own private businesses than public, first off. I mean, again, 3,500 public businesses. You know,
there's a lot more businesses out there than 3,500.
Yeah. Again, I think it comes back to just understanding the range of outcome is so great. Jeff Bezos being the top and a negative net worth being the bottom, negative whatever, right? Actually in debt more than you have. That's honestly, a lot of times it's like college student loans, like, is actually what drives negative net worth. It's like the most obvious tangible version of that. But people forget that exists as negative net worth. Again, I don't think there's a fast track to it. I think there's magnificently larger number of non-successful things that you don't hear about the names of those people that had a great idea and it just, what, for whatever reason didn't work. Again, I think it's that the easiest path to wealth is probably, again, boring discipline and really understanding what risks are worth taking. And that's really specific to everyone's life, right? Like, their life and their finances, and, like, so whoever's listening, take that with, like, for what it's worth. Like, non-descriptive, but I think it's so specific. Like Jeff, you think about it, like the risk Jeff Bezos took. He left a super stable job where he was probably still going to be worth a lot of money one day, and went to something that his bosses at the time thought was ludicrous. You can sell books on the internet. And so that was, you know, I don't know what his finances were like at the time, but was that risk worth taking? Of course it is in hindsight. But it could have gone terribly wrong, and he could have been back at his previous job 6 months later, or 10 years later or something. Ah, it didn't work out, so I'm going to go back into whatever he was doing before. And yeah, there's definitely like, there's shortcuts, but there's probably no like reliable shortcut. I would say like a vast majority, I'm trying to think, is there anyone, I don't think we work with anyone that's had like that random shortcut that's shown up and it was easy. I don't think we've had anyone like that.
So what are your wealthy clients doing that your average human's not?
It sounds crazy, but it's really as simple as delayed gratification. Like, there's some that are
just save more, and invest at a greater percentages.
Basis? I mean, think about like your first year out of college, what's the least fun thing you can think about is like retirement and estate planning, and most people probably like don't think about estate planning and whatever. Like that's like for, you know, their grandparents or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the next least enticing thing that someone 22 or 23 can think about is like putting money into an account they can't get to till they're 60, right? Like that is so boring sounding, right? Because like, oh, that's like almost 40 years. Like I'll get there eventually. Like I'll start in a couple, like, and frankly, that's probably the first misstep, but it's like the first decision that is, could be done better, right? Like yeah. Delicately, like you don't have to fully do that. It's small behaviors. It's deciding, you know what, I actually can't afford like X, Y, Z. Like I have credit cards I got to pay off, or I've got student loans. And it's like, those are the least fun things when you're 25. Like I dealt with these same things, like getting out of school. Fortunately, I didn't have any student loans, but like I still had to make ends meet. And it was like, all right, I can't do this, I can't do that. And, you know, watching people go off and travel and stuff, like that's, I'm really stoked for them. But at the same time, like I can't do that because, I mean, I could, but I know like being in this business, like I know like, what does that mean? It means that's going to cost me down the road. Maybe I can outpace it with income, but maybe not. Like if you don't, like, kind of compounds the negative way. And so most of the people we work with are that case where they just made a lot of really small good decisions and like saved early, saved frequently, just lived within their means. And like that is like magnificently powerful and the least sexy advice ever, like the least sexy thing to talk about. But I think it's also really true is simple principles like that will probably keep you out of problems financially and like and just will actually build positively bigger than people think. You kind of hear about like a number of times where people said, I can't believe my house would sell for this much, or like, I can't move because what am I going to go buy? It's like, all right, well, if you move from house A that you bought for 100 grand and now it's like 500 grand, like, do you ever think it was going to sell for that? Like, probably not, but again, it's not sexy, but they just never believed it. And, they did enough to do it. And, I'd say most people we work with is that's why they're wealthy is like, I wouldn't say a fear of being not wealthy. I don't want to say poor, but just like a little bit of a, probably a healthy concern for not having and being, not cautious, but just really thoughtful. And even if it wasn't super thoughtful, just being diligent. And it's, again, it's like the most boring sounding answer, but I think it's just really true. Couple people have had unique situations, but
sure,
most not.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I think about, okay, I've been here 33 years.
Yeah.
You know, breathing, active. I was a gleam in somebody's eye 33 and a half years ago.
Yeah.
You know, most, it feels a lot like the reference that's made towards sailing. It's hours of boredom with brief moments of terror. And it feels like I'm saving all this money and I don't really know why. personally, Austin feels that way. Yeah. So I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. And then Mark Cuban, Dallas Mavericks owner, publicly traded with a couple of firms and Shark Tank, and not really somebody I need to introduce, but at the same time, he said, it is always okay to pass on a deal and keep the cash in the bank.
Yes.
Than to throw it down something you're unsure of. And it was like, oh, that makes sense. That's what we're waiting on.
Yeah.
You know, when the obvious answer is very obvious and it'd be foolish not to participate.
Yeah.
That's when you do it. I know there's gut things, there's intuition, there's predictions and yada yada, but that's what I asked Haley recently. I said, hey, what can we invest in? That's not the stock market.
Yeah.
She goes, businesses.
Yeah.
People's businesses.
Yeah.
I go, well, how do I do that? And then one of the questions I've been wanting to ask a finance expert, but I'm probably not going to like the answer you give me, is how do I become an accredited investor before I'm worth $1 million and before I've earned 200K annually or 300 combined with a spouse? Like, because there's lists you can get on.
Yeah.
There's opportunities you can get, but you have to be at the number. In between that, like, 150, 200K, and that million net worth, like, you're grinding and you're building. Yeah. What do you do there?
Yeah. Frankly, I don't know. Like, I have no idea how you would go about, I don't want to say skirting, but bypassing or accelerating your process to those levels. I have no idea what the... I didn't even know there was an avenue to it. It's one of those things where a lot of times that criteria is there for a particular reason, because it's probably coming with some inherent risk. Forget volatility, like illiquidity or something like that that people don't think about. And I don't know. I've never come across that.
So I went and Googled list you can get on private equity firms.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm like, I'm not waiting. Yeah. You know, like, I want to know what the number is and why they need this number.
Yeah.
You know, and it is exactly what you said. It is, you don't need the money.
Yeah.
At some point. So your percentage of investment versus total net worth is really low. And then the other part is they don't want you calling them asking for your money back.
Correct.
Like,
it's they don't want you. Working capital. It's different than investing in a stock portfolio, like an S&P or some whatever it is, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was, you know, in my head, football player Austin wants his money now.
Yeah.
He married wisely, and she thinks long term.
Yeah.
And so there is a nice little balance there.
Yeah.
You know.
But there's something to be said for also recognizing the long term is a lot of short term periods. That was something that it...
Say that again?
The long term, call it 60 years.
Okay.
Let's say you lived to 93. 60 years.
Yeah.
There's a year one and a year two and a year three that you have to consider too. It's so easy for people in my seat to just be like, ah, focus on the long term. And it's so important to understand that 60 years is not the only time frame that's relevant. So there's a balance that has to be struck, kind of like what you said between you and Haley. Same for us.
Yeah.
If it was, and same for Warren Buffett. Like, he talks about this in his, like, in the HBO thing on him, where had it not been for his wife, he would have just kept investing for charity and none of it would have ever gone to charity. Oh, but I can still get my whatever percent. And it'll just get bigger and bigger and it'll be that much, 15% more next year. It's like, okay, well, it's doing zero for good now.
Gotcha.
So this balance of, like, kind of the gas and the brakes or, like, the sails and the keel, like, are actually really important. Like, the idea of, like, just focusing on the 60-year time frame makes a ton of math sense. Or humans, like.
Yeah.
You know, so being able to
balance. My car just broke down. What do I care about 60 years from now?
Exactly. Or, like, hey, I'm only going to be 33 for another X months, right? Like, you know, or we're going to have kids. Like, we're not going to be able to do this big trip to, ours was Italy, and then COVID struck. But, like, there's times where you just can't get that time back. And so it really is, this is that human thing, like, why people make decisions. Like, understanding both our attention against each other, right? Like, the human thing is, like, do the thing now. The math thing and, like, my human thing is, like, do the thing later because, like, I just grow the money long term, like, whatever. And but those two things are, like, equally important data points to understand.
Yeah.
And they're in constant tension with each other. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing wrong with understanding, like, 60 is a bunch of 1-year time periods, right? Like, that's
yeah
easy to forget that.
We're about to land the plane, and I was gonna see if somebody wanted to follow up with you and get in touch with you. How could they do that?
Yeah, if they wanted to, they could just shoot me a quick email. I guess which one's better, work or personal?
Do the work one.
It's super easy. It's my name, Danny, at fmbwealth.com.
Okay. Are you on social?
Nope.
Oh, that's right. You dipped off.
I'm on LinkedIn.
So all right. Yeah, LinkedIn. That's
about it. Actually, that's exclusively it.
Okay. And then F&B Wealth Management here in what city? West Lake Village. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any final words of wisdom for lessons Danny's learned? Like, in my envision, you've walked up to the podium.
Yeah.
You have people's attention.
Yeah.
And maybe you need to crystallize it for you.
Yeah.
But maybe someone else needs to hear it. That's kind of
interesting.
If you gave a commencement speech at your high school.
Yeah, so we went through an exercise last week with a prospective client. It was really interesting, and it was like the first real go at this, and it went even better than I thought. And we had them walk through a little bit of an exercise where they got a letter from descendants 100 years from now about what they heard about them, and if they could basically dictate what that letter sounded like. So it was a couple of prompted questions, and there was a legacy statement that basically outlined what, like, their motivation, like, kind of crystallized everything that when we think about them in four sentences, like what we should think about for that, which was really impactful. And I think everyone should probably go through that process, call it a mission statement or a legacy statement or something like that. But it was really cool to hear. And it was about what they believe about family and friends and how important that is, and how money's it's a tool, not an end. And it's really easy to forget that. And also their faith was huge to them. And so, like, that gave us an insight into that person, that couple, more than I think just kind of talking about their wealth and what do you care about? Like, no, this was impactful for me, even. Forget the professional side. I was like, wow, that's cool. I would encourage everyone to probably sit down with their significant other and actually think what that would look like if someone 100 years from now described them. And that would be a pretty good probably direction to start heading with decisions from that point on.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Feels very similar to Stephen Covey's Begin With the End in Mind.
There you go. I haven't read it. It's on the soon.
Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
Oh, yeah. I haven't read it, but like that's...
One of them's Begin With the End in Mind.
Yeah. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's my Chick-fil-A in me getting beat out.
Boom.
That they use Stephen Covey a lot.
So, yeah. Why make it up when someone said it better?
Just exactly. Chick-fil-A. It was not the only Chick-fil-A.
I'd like to revise my statement to say exactly what he said.
Oh.
Begin with the end of mind. But don't forget about the short periods that make up all the way to the end.
Yeah, that's fascinating, man.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Well, thank you so much for coming. This has been awesome.
Thanks to Danny for joining Call Me on the Way Home. Be sure to check out the next episode. Austin will be interviewing Becky Blackman. Have a blessed week and be sure to bless others.